Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm just going to make a little introduction because I'm recording this. I'm going to make a little introduction of what we're doing. The series on Judaism was completed probably a year and a half ago or maybe more. And the class on Torah was not, just by the way it went, we didn't publish that class. And so now I have the privilege of learning with a group in Jacksonville, Florida, who has been studying this book and also reviewing some of our classes. And we are getting together on Hanukkah end of 2017, 57, 78, and we are learning this chapter called Torah, the fourth chapter of the book on Judaism. Now, what I didn't mention to the group, and maybe you know this from earlier things, is that I am mega privileged to teach this topic at all because I read this book in 1996, shortly after it came out. I loved it. I thought it was an important primer to be able to help people. I continue personally to grow from the book. I think it's one of those it's rare that you get a book that's sort of great for beginners and great for the advanced, and I find that that's the case here in Rabbi Feldman's book. About 2 years after I read the book, I met the author's granddaughter, and shortly thereafter, she became my wife. So Zadie, he should live me well till 120, lives in Yerushalayim, and every so often I talk with him about the book, and he knows that I did this lecture series, and so that this is continuing, I will certainly share with him this incredible thing, and he would love to know about it, and he loves to talk to people when they're in Jerusalem and visit with him, and he is, thank God, although an advanced number of age, he's an extremely youthful person and ready to help. So for me, this is just extra special in that way. So we're picking up in this fourth chapter, and in some ways, you could argue that this is the most important topic in Judaism, because there's a lot of other esoteric things and application things, but bottom line, if you were going to define what is Judaism and define what does it mean to be Jewish, you would have to define it in the context of Torah. You know, that in fact, the Talmud, not the Talmud, the Zohar says, Yisrael ve'oraiso ve'kudsha brichu chad, that the Jewish people, the Torah and God is all one thing. That's one notion. There's no such thing as the Jewish people without describing them in their relationship with Hashem. And if you want to define what is God, you have to define God in terms of He's the God of the Jewish people who gave them the Torah, who has given them this instruction book of how to live their lives. And that's what makes it so incredibly core. And this is a concept. It comes back a few times in the context of this chapter about how I think he refers to it as the commandment par excellence or something along that line. That it's so central to who we are and what it means to be Jewish. In fact, right there near the beginning in page 92, he writes that that you can't really have Judaism without Torah. I'm near the bottom of the page in the longest excerpt of the rabbi's sentence. It says, the sad fact is, however, that those groups that have been unable to come to terms with the divine origin of the Torah are having a difficult time in stemming assimilation, intermarriage within their ranks, and are experiencing serious problems in holding on to their young people. It's an indisputable fact that the alarming number of these young people are abandoning Judaism entirely and drifting off into assimilation and intermarriage, or at best, complete indifference to Judaism. I don't think this is a coincidence. Meaning, lack of Torah will, if it's sustainable in a single generation, perhaps it's sustainable. But beyond that, over a certain period of time where there's lack of Torah, there's lack of Jewish identity. There's lack of being Jewish at all. Because, of course, there are tens of millions of people who walk the face of the earth who come from the Jews, but have no idea that they're Jewish. How do they know that they, and they're only technically Jewish in that sense. So what is missing? No element of other Jewish identity attempts will hold on to the Jews, except for Torah, Torah knowledge, Torah observance, the bonding agent between Hashem and his people. That's it. That's what I think is part of the notion of Yisrael v'Arayis of Kud Shabichu Chad, that the Jewish people and God and the Torah is one, because they're one. There's no way, these are indispensable parts. Just by the way, as for Torah itself, the Jewish people are indispensable, because who will be the practitioners of it? Who will carry it out? The angels say in the Talmud that the Torah shouldn't be given to mankind. And Moshe responds, what do you mean? Who will carry it out if you don't give it to mankind? And of course, it is our bond and our connection to the divine will and even the divine, if you will, the divine intellect. So I don't think it can be overstated, the centrality of it. Now on page 93, the rabbi gets to what might be the most important question that anybody could ask. And that is there a God and did he ever talk to mankind? If you've ever gone to a discovery seminar, then this is the heart and soul of discovery. And I have the privilege of, I give discovery seminars all over the place whenever they'll have me. And I love to talk about this because kind of just having an ethnic hunch that Torah is the real thing doesn't really work. It's not going to make somebody feel fully committed. Children, grandchildren, other people, they see through this sort of, you should do this holiday because that's your ethnicity, but if we would have accidentally been born to the neighbor, then we would keep that holiday. There's something more, there ought to be something more profound than that kind of approach. And so it all does come back to the real question of, would a thinking, rational person believe that God gave the Torah? Or is it just a matter of blind faith? And so here the rabbi presents one of the rational underpinnings that a person should believe or could believe, could conclude that God wrote the Torah. This particular argument or discussion is available online at great length from the rabbi and author, Rabbi Lawrence Kellerman. And he talks about the divine origin, divine authorship of the Torah. Years ago, and I think it's still true, it's still the most often downloaded lecture from the website simpletoremember.com. Divine authorship of the Torah. Just to confuse you, the first time somebody told me to go to simpletoremember.com, I went to easytoremember.com, and it wasn't there. I don't think anything was there. So remember, simpletoremember.com.
Simple to remember.
Yeah, exactly. And so this argument is that every single religion is based on a revelation narrative. There has to be the moment that the people say, God told us so. That's common to all religious practices. There's the Joseph Smith Mormon version of it, and there's the Siddhartha version of it, and whatever. Everybody has the version of this is when this religious set of practices became incumbent upon us because the Almighty told us through his prophet or whatever it may be. All of those stories claim that there are very few people at the event. Because if you would claim that there are four people at the event, all four people have to continue to tell the lie together if it's a lie. So if we assume for the moment that it's a lie, meaning you either the event happened as it's recorded, or at some point in human history, somebody introduced it. Those are the only two options. Either it did happen, or if it did not happen, somebody at some point in human history introduced it as a notion. Now, when that happens, the easiest thing to sell is that I was there when God spoke to me. On the one hand, it's the hardest thing to sell, because why should I believe you? I believe that any religion that starts with one person at the revelation narrative is going to probably be a combination of two things. Number one, tremendous charisma from the person in the middle of the picture. And number two, it's probably selling something relatively easy. Something that's allowing the people to get out of responsibilities, not take on responsibilities. And so if you would add a second person, it would have more credibility. But if I was the guy who had the partner, two of us are trying what's that fancy economic word? To collude. Two of us are trying to collude in the lie. The goal of each person in the lie, see, we get into it for a reason, whatever it may be, to split the delicious things, to split the money that we're going to take from people, or the advantage we're going to take of them. And then, I better make sure my partner is happy all the time, or eventually the partner is going to say, this whole thing's been a lie. If you had a third or fourth person, every one of the people has to continue telling the lie. Because the moment anybody tells that's not a lie, the whole thing is blown up. It says it was a lie, the whole thing blows up. That's why it's less credible to have one, but the more people you add, the more unlikely it is that the lie will be continued to be colluded around. No revelation narrative in human history records more than four people at the narrative. I'm going to repeat that. There's hundreds of revelation narratives. None of them includes more than four people at the narrative. Because let's say the five of us colluded right now to tell this story, that we have a new religion and you have to give us money or whatever it may be. We're in it together. I hate to say this to you. It's not very nice what I'm about to say. But my goal, if the five of us sold people on it, my next goal would basically be to see to you four being killed. Okay, because I have to get you dead before you tell everybody that it's not true. Sick as it sounds, it's really the truth, right? So enter the Torah story, that in the story, there are millions of people present. Our story is that millions of people were there when God spoke to the Jewish people at Sinai. I say millions because, as the rabbi says, I think it's on 94 or so, he says there were 600,000 men between the ages of 20 and 60. It's actually at the top of 95. And if you extrapolate that out to women and children and older adults, there must have been millions of people there, 2 to 3 million people there. So grasp how audacious that lie is, if it's a lie. No one tells that there are more than four. We come and say there were millions. The sheer audaciousness of the claim would suggest that it's true. Because how can you make that up? If it was a lie and it was introduced at some point. Hey folks, millions of us were there. You were there. You would say, no, I wasn't there. Oh, no, you weren't there, but your grandparents were there. Millions of our grandparents were there, but nobody ever told me. And then within the claim, the Torah says it will never be forgotten. It's written near the end of the Torah. What we write in the Torah will never be forgotten. The only way you can make it up is if you also claim that it was forgotten. The reason you never heard about it is because it was forgotten. But in the claim it says it will never be forgotten. So this is one example of something that a rational thinking person might conclude there's something different about this narrative than all other narratives. And there's something that suggests that it's true. I'm giving you the 5-minute version of what takes a little bit more time to think through completely, but is for me personally extremely compelling and among the bedrock elements of why I believe that the Torah comes from heaven. Once one has that, by the way, this is a very interesting thing and addresses one of the questions that was asked earlier. Sometimes one's conclusion that there is a God could come, what I would say, through the back door. Meaning, I'm not sure there's a God. The whole wisdom about there has to be a God, there isn't, that doesn't make sense to me per se. But the Torah could not have written by anybody else. If I have a book whose author must be divine, then there must be a divine source. And that for me is very powerful. Like I sometimes joke, if I was alive in the time of Abraham, I would not have been with him. I would have said, I don't get it. Like, what do you're making this claim. Well, how can there be a world without a creator? Whatever. I'm happy to do my own thing. But once you have these elements of Torah itself has a divine author, then it begins to etch a sketch of who God is or that God exists. Any questions on the things that we talked about so far?
Torah was written by a person, would that then make that person divine and with the whole conception of God as we know God, what would happen to God then if we learn that there was the divine, I guess divine person is sort of a contradiction in terms, but what if there was some like incredibly intuned human that did this?
Well, I'm going to make the argument that is not the case. Okay, so, and that it can't be the case. We all live our lives on assumptions based on evidence that don't actually have concrete proof. So, for example, there's this woman in my life. I've known her for 42 years. She's been very, very nice to me over a very long period of time.
Mommy?
She claims to be my mom. Okay? She claims to be my mom. And maybe she is my mom. It's pretty reasonable. She looks like the woman in the pictures from the 70s. The whole narrative does suggest that she's still the same person that's my mom. Her name is on the hospital records. But is it possible that she's not my mom? Of course it's possible. Right? From the very beginning, she might have duped the people in, at some point, some actress could have taken over. So it's possible, but it's illogical. So therefore, I live all elements of my life fully and completely committed to the fact that she's my mom. So though I don't, make physical contact with women in general, I hug and kiss this woman because she's my mom. I don't have 100% proof. But it's reasonable to conclude that. So the idea, if we present some of the evidence that the Almighty must be the author of the Torah, that a all-wise being has to be the author, I think there are only two choices of who the Torah could be. Maybe you can call it three choices. Either the author is God, or the author is a person, or the author is a group of people. There are no other reasonable positions. If the authors are a group of people, or the author is a certain person, there are several things that they would have had to dupe us into believing. Like I said, for example, the event at Sinai would have not happened, but they would have to dupe us into believing it. Because there's a moment they introduce it to a group of people that did not experience it. I find that wholly implausible. I'd also have to argue that although people have ranged in their intellect within a bell curve, and such that you'll have an Einstein emerge every so often, I'd have to argue that some one person exists way beyond trillions of units beyond the curve. I find that also implausible. It's not impossible, but it's implausible. And improbable. So when you also add in, like, let's say, for example, whoever wrote the Torah wrote that no other group will ever claim national revelation. And that's been true. Who knew that? Whoever wrote the Torah wrote that the pig is the only animal that has split hooves but doesn't chew its cud. And that's still true. Who could have known that? So you get into the space where it has to be either this divine person, as you described, somebody who's taken on divinity or you know, and how would that turn Judaism on its side? I just find the construction not entirely reasonable. It's not entirely reasonable that there is such a new notion of being that has no peer and no context to understand it at all. That's what it seems to me. Okay? Any other questions for now?
I would love for you to address and talk about the revelation. I found it so powerful to think about how each soul was ignited and connected with the divine. And that image touched me deeply. You know, it was, I guess my question really is, why, with all of our wonderful Jewish schools, religious school educations, retelling the story of the Exodus, does it somehow, for someone like myself who grew up in Reform and who has been involved and affiliated for decades, that hasn't, I haven't really heard it told that way.
Okay, so I have a very long answer to your question, but I'm going to try to say it briefly. And I think I've said it in other lectures. I don't remember where. And so you might have heard this concept before. We all have the struggle of how do we give to our children what you just described? How do we give to our children a sense of the magic of the Sinai encounter? I have a teacher from New York. His name is Rabbi Moshe Weinberger, who's been a very big inspiration in my life, who asked your question in a different way. He said, "Why?" He was talking about Orthodox people. He was saying, why is it that we teach our children Torah and Jewish law, halacha, and we teach them Talmud, and yet you have people are not necessarily succeeding at giving their children the spark that you just described. So what he said is the foundation of our family's educational philosophy for our own children. And he said the following. At Sinai, two things happened. People think that one thing happened at Sinai. And that thing is that the Torah was taught, the Torah was given by God to the Jewish people. If the whole thing that happened at Sinai was the Torah was given, you can do that without the thunder and lightning. You can do that without the revelation. You can hand over information. Here's the info. But a second thing happened there. And the second thing that happened there, besides the Torah that was given there, was Sinai itself. The thunder and the lightning and the wonderment. When you asked your question, you talked about telling it over that way. I don't think it can be told over that way. I think that a child has to see in his or her parent, a congregant has to see in his or her rabbi, a peer has to see in his or her peer, that this person's on fire and in touch with God. That there's real, and it's a struggle. It can be a struggle to feel that. But we have to give over not only the information. You see, we live in an information age. You should know, in the Orthodox educational system, the information age is gigantic. What I mean is, there's all these books. And within these books, there are better translations than 20 years ago. More footnotes in the highest scholarly books. This tractate and its commentary, Tosfos, now has on the side where you can find this comment also discussed someplace else. We have all the tools for the info, but the info is not enough. The info is not what will ignite the soul. It's bringing people to the foot of Sinai. We have two daughters that are not at home on a daily basis. That one is in Israel, and the second one, who's 16, is in high school in Cincinnati, Ohio. And she made sure, and multiple times yesterday, made sure that it would not happen that she would miss my candle lighting at home by video call. I'm hesitant to say it in this way, but it's really the truth. It wasn't about, you know, well, oh, I want to be together, family, you know, sweet moment. It was mentioned by my son at his bar mitzvah. He said, you know, when my father lights the Hanukkah candles, you see what it means to have joy in the performance of the mitzvahs. So she wasn't going to be home. She's coming home Friday for the Shabbos. She wasn't going to be home. She needed to be a part of that. And that's very meaningful to me, very deeply meaningful to me. But what I'm really trying to say is that if the pedagogical technique is about giving over the info, it'll only take you so far. It has to be about coming in contact with Sinai. And that's why, by the way, that where you have a lack of observance in the presence of knowledge, it can only go so far. The knowledge and the observance and the sincerity and the piety and the fire have to come together. So I can't hold myself back. I got to tell you a story. I got to tell you a story that is a little bit off topic, but it's something I learned from Rabbi Weinberger. The story goes that there was a and forgive me if this was in like last week's lecture, but last week's lecture was 2 years ago, you know, so I'm not sure. There's a story that goes that there was a national poetry reading contest. And students from all over the country whittled down in little local tournaments until they were selected to come to the finals. And at the finals, they again gave them readings to do, competitive readings. You read this and you read it. And it came down to two finalists. And when it came to the final finalists, the judge said, the final reading is Psalm 23. Psalm 23 is a song of David. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. So these two finalists were excellent, but one of them was far more excellent than the other. This young man was brilliant, and when he was done, the whole place exploded into applause. It was clear he was going to win. Just as they were about to crown him victor, an old, aged, rattled Jewish man stands up from the back of the room and walks down the central aisle and says, "Excuse me, judges, I know I'm not in the contest, but can you give me a chance to do the reading anyway? I'd like to do this reading publicly." So the judges say, okay, fine. So the old man stands by the microphone and reads it. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." And when he's concluded, the entire room is in tears. They go back to the regularly scheduled programming, and the young man is crowned victor, and everybody celebrates him and take pictures, and then the room empties until only the old man and the young man are in the room. And the young man says, "Excuse me, sir, I have to ask you a question. When I read, everybody exploded with applause. But when you read, everyone was in tears. What was the difference?" So the old man said to the young man a simple thing. He said, "The difference is that I know the shepherd. I know the shepherd." When people see someone else who knows the shepherd, that's when the magic of Sinai comes across. That's when you know, in the turn of the 20th century, Jews had a very hard time in America keeping being observant, and many people fought hard, and they did. And then in the middle part of the 20th century, they lost many of their children to lack of observance and assimilation. And there was this line, there was this quotation, sometimes actually attributed to one of the greatest people ever, that they used to say in Yiddish, it's difficult to be a Jew. As schwer wird sein Yid. It's difficult. What do you want? It's difficult to be a Jew. If you want a failing proposal in 2017, give over that message. That is the biggest failure possible. Like, I'll guarantee failure. But if you give over that the world is filled with excitement, but there are things even more exciting than my team winning the championship. There's connection to something profound. Like, there was a great rabbi from a few hundred years ago, Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev. And they say about the Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev that on the day after Simchas Torah, he couldn't sleep that night. So why could he not sleep the night after Simchas Torah? Not because of the exhilaration of Simchas Torah. Because according to most, that tradition, and there's two different traditions around this, he didn't put on his tefillin for the first 2 days of Sukkot and all of the middle intermediate days and the last 2 days. He hadn't put on his tefillin in 9 days. And out of the sheer excitement to be able to put on his tefillin again, he couldn't sleep. That is how you give over the fire of Sinai. You can't give it over with the details in the story. Doesn't work. Has to be through passion and fire. Okay, let's go on to a few more things within the chapter with the time that we have. And I have about... I have about 15 more minutes available, basically. Okay. So it's an interesting thing. On page 96, the rabbi is dealing with the question of like what happens when there are changes. It's on the bottom of 96. Times change, situations change. How is Torah, even though it is eternal, applied to new conditions? And this is actually a fascinating thing for those who are not familiar with it, that both Jewish law and Jewish like outlook on life confront new challenges. There are new challenges with the outlook on life. You know, like how do you deal with the advent of cell phones and the popularity of cell phones that do everything among 12-year-olds? You know, how do you deal with that? Nobody would have said to their child when I was growing up, I think you should have a copy of every single magazine that's published in America in your room. Just make good decisions about it. I want you to have a copy of every magazine published, but just make good decisions. It would not have happened. I want you to have a copy of every movie that came out this year, but just make good decisions. I didn't hear you, what you said. Yeah. So when you have Torah greats saying, these are the kinds of approaches you should have to this or that, it's a new situation. And it's not necessarily halachic, you know, legal. It's about outlook on life. You know, what are the challenges of the evolving educational norms or moral conditions in America? How do we approach that? And you need great, great people to be shepherds of the Jewish people and tell them this is the best way, or this is the unique and specific nuanced way where this thing changes. And things change over every few years. And that's why we're so gifted to have great, great Torah scholars, profound giants. You know, I'm sure you probably heard in the news that one of the giants of Torah passed away yesterday, Rabbi Aaron Leib Steinman. I don't have a personal relation with him at all. But when you sense that people that I wanted advice from said, let's go to this one, and then the pyramid moves up, and they say, no, the only one who can give you the greatest advice about this would be this great sage. It's amazing. It's amazing. And by the way, Torah has a great retirement plan also, because you get more relevant as you get old, not less. You know? It's a cool thing. But in halacha, in Jewish law, I mean, I could, from now until the end of time, give you examples of how new things create scenarios where you need people who understand all the old rules to apply to the new situations. Here's a nice little sweet one. When I was a small child, America was was in some sense the center of the Torah world. That is no longer true. Israel is clearly like where the greatest people on earth live and where they respond to great halachic questions. But when I was a small child, just the presence of this one towering figure, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, made it that the Lower East Side of New York was where the biggest questions in the world went to. And he published his letters that he would write back to people about their halachic questions. And it now is up to 9 volumes because they have, posthumously, they've his family has published 2 more volumes of his letters. And so in that book, you have every kind of question in every realm of Jewish life. Here's one that's kind of cute. What's the proper blessing on cornflakes? Okay, there's different blessings we say on different foods. Foods that come out of the ground have this blessing. If they are bread, they have this blessing. If they come off of a tree, they're this blessing. If they are none of those things, then there's a fourth type of blessing, and so on. You're familiar with these. Most people know Borei Priya Gafen and Hamotzi Lecha Min Haaretz. But there are others also, Borei Priya Adama, Borei Priya Eitz, Shakol Niyabidvaro, different applications. So they asked him, Rebbe, what do we say on cornflakes? Is it corn? If it's corn, you say Borei Priya Adama. If it's not, no longer has the category of being called corn, then it would be like a catch-all. So would you believe that till this very day, there's a difference between the blessing you say on Kellogg's cornflakes and on generic cornflakes? Because to this day, Kellogg's cornflakes, they take a piece of corn and they smash it. That does not fit the category of being considered removed from the status of corn. But other brands, they make it into a fine flour, and then they randomly form it into these flake substances. They've already been removed from being corn. So there's 2 different blessings. Frosted flakes, by the way, would be the same question. Okay? So you're thinking, who eats cornflakes anywhere? But I know you eat frosted flakes. It's okay. So you say, though, well, that seems a little bit like, you know, narrow, but for people who want to have a real relationship with God, and we talk about this in the speed bumps class a lot, if you want to have a real relationship with God, you care about the details, right? Just like if I give you a gift, you care about the details, the wrapping, the presentation, the wonderment. Nobody wants to give a diamond ring in a paper bag and leave it on the bed and go out and watch, you know, football with the boys. What kind of gift is that? So it's all in the details. And so there's a difference. Pringles and all other potato chips have a different blessing. Same philosophy, right? Those are old rules, modern, contemporary application. But it's obviously there's many more, much more complicated things. You have surrogate parents. So if she's the donor, but she's the carrier, who's the mom in halacha? It's a very important question, a very difficult question in halacha. If you have somebody who owns stocks and in a company, but not a controlling amount, and the company is making money on the Sabbath, is that called making money on the Sabbath? Or the company owns chametz, leavened products, on Pesach. Is that a problem? Am I prohibiting that? We're moving from realm to realm, totally different places, where the great sages of the different generations have to be on top of their game. And things are coming out nowadays all the time. New things. People sending me, pictures of new kitchen gadgets. You know, is this permitted on Shabbos and it's not permitted on Shabbos? Hotels are becoming increasingly automated. You know, are you trapped in your room if the light goes on in the hallway the moment you go out of the thing? The light you had inserted in Jacksonville on San Jose Boulevard, it picks up people's heat waves or whatever it does, right? So how does that apply to the laws of the Shabbos? And maybe the holidays are different and so on. So one of the takeaways I would say, which Rabbi Feldman does not talk about in this chapter as far as I remember, but we have to think about, is that we as a global community are happy to invest in specialization so long as we view the specialization as important. So for example, I have a brother-in-law who is a resident in radiation oncology. Nobody wants him to also be a qualified accountant. We want him to be the best oncologist he can be. And we know that his particular discipline, when we, God forbid, would need him, we want people specialized in that. So there's a tremendous number of observant people who will give huge amounts of money to support those in full-time Torah study. And to some of us, it feels like, But why? We're all Jews. We all have to study and we all have to work. If we won't invest in specialists, who will answer the questions that come up? And we can't even imagine the questions that are yet coming. Because every generation has the new things that the previous generation could have never imagined. You know, can you fulfill your obligation of hearing the Megillah if the person's using a microphone? What about if it's over the telephone? What about if it's on tape? Or MP3, excuse me for the archaic, you know, reference. You know, so on and so forth. These are all things that we must invest in great decisors of Torah in order so that we can continue to have guidance. And not only that, let me add another thing. We need people who are anchored in proper philosophies and not lost by the things that tempt us all to become lost in. So even if you don't talk about legalistic issues, just again, how do we handle this type of educational question or this type of approach to something? Every family needs a parent to be anchored so that as the kids see new things, the parent can say, hang on a second, you know, this is not necessarily correct. So by having Torah scholars who are engaged full time and with great personal sacrifice. And I was in the house of Rabbi Eliyashiv, who was the greatest Torah mind until he passed away maybe 5-6 years ago. He lived in a tiny little house and his whole life was the study of Torah and the responses to people's questions. He wasn't confused by, you know, things that confuse me, like which football team is winning this weekend because it really matters to me. He was all in on being anchored and being, and that, and even though we may say to ourselves, I don't want to be like him, and that may be true, but we need that anchor that there are people like him that hold us clear and give us guidance. Okay, thoughts or questions? It looks like you have a question.
Selection process in among scholars studying Torah that sort of assures that the more intuitive and intellectual will actually rise to the top, and as they get older and older, we need those stages.
Right. Okay, so I think there are two questions you're asking, okay? One question is, how do we know who those great people are once they've become that great person? Right? In other words, how does the world see, and maybe this isn't your question, but I think it's an important topic either way, how does the world know who to go to for these questions? And the second question is, when they're 20 or 25, how does the process work to try to gear those people towards becoming those people and then not quote unquote waste money on the others, okay, who could be more productive, right? So the answering the first element, it's important to understand that there's basically constant, daily, all the time peer review. It's not in any official capacity. It's as simple as, there was a doctor here in Phoenix who retired last year, a neurologist by the name of Spetzler. He was so highly regarded that we knew, people would know in town that, you know, the king of some small municipality across the world is here for neurosurgery at Barrows with this doctor. And I'm sure every discipline in every city has some people like that where they say he's one of the world's best. Now, whether Dr. Spetzler would have been elected chief of this or chief of that is of no consequence. When you go to your local practitioner, the regular doctor says, you got to go to a neurologist. You go to the neurologist, he says, I'm not sure how to help you. We got to go to this neurologist. Until it comes and somebody says, you need to fly to Phoenix from Bahrain to be with this physician. And that's much like how the Torah world works also. The moment that that person is no longer capable of that, or has been proven to be losing it, or isn't really as good as we thought he was, the world automatically disregards that person to some degree. Now in the case, by the way, of Torah, they don't stop honoring that person if in old age that person becomes, you know, less capable. In fact, the Talmud says that a Torah scholar who has totally forgotten his scholarship, you must stand, rise in his presence nevertheless. And the proof is that that the tablets that Moses broke were also in the ark. The tablets that he eventually got second were there, but the tablets that he broke were also in the ark. So that concept that broken tablets are also in the ark means this old man who no longer knows anything, and by the way, his wife. You should know there's the law reflects that the wife of said scholar deserves the same level of honor as the scholar because they're in it together and they've built, you know, together. And so he still gets the honor, but the world will nevertheless remove its focus on him as the great decider of that thing because he no longer has that capability, or sometimes it will be because of behavior, not necessarily because of scholarship. Somebody will just realize the man does not have the integrity to be this. Now that's addressing topic one. So it's constant peer review. Unofficial, but just clear to the world. The second one is dicier. And I would say it's dicier because of two elements. I studied Torah full time after marriage for 3.5 years before I had any kind of real income. I mean, I made a few bucks, you know what I mean, from the kol I was studying in and from tutoring and the like. But I didn't have a job until I was married 3.5 years. Now, the overall Western philosophy might have said, that's crazy. Like, what do you mean? You got to first have the job, then the wife, then the kids. And I had it, the wife, and then the kids, and then the job. Now, people invested in me. The yeshiva itself invested by a small stipend that people, their supporters, gave. My parents invested in me. My in-laws invested in me in different ways. My wife invested in me big time. She was working. She was the one investing really the most in me. And that's a very common behavior among young married people in devoutly religious environments. Here's the kicker. Even when they will not become those kinds of scholars, because the world has reached a point where they want to build their family life in the context, in the anchoring of the continued studies during that era of their lifetime. So the phenomenon of lots of people studying full time is not only in order to create the great experts. It's also in order to build families on a foundation of Torah first approach in their life before they go and go conquer the world, if you will, you know, with the things that can derail us all. Now, in addition to that, some of it is financial. The one who comes from said family where that's their values and they want that for their kid and they can, they do it. The next one cannot, they don't do it. It's true that we have a faith system that says, if you're willing to sacrifice, God will provide for you, even if you don't work. But the provide for you doesn't mean, you know, your tickets to the Jaguars game will be in the fourth row. They'll mean no tickets to the Jaguars game because that's not interesting to you. And God will provide for you and you won't have the newest countertop, you know, so to speak. So, and then beyond that, the world does say, just by its natural reality, say, boy, oh boy, I want to invest in those people. And often might even think, if I've already seen what's happened with the father, I bet you the kids or grandkids might be worth investing in as well. And so the world does support great Torah scholars in order to continue to give them the strength to continue to be that way. You're welcome. Okay. I have much more to say, but unfortunately I need to go. Let me just see. I want to add one last thing, okay? Torah is, of course, a guidebook for life. It's not just good suggestions. It's really the Almighty's commands to us about how we're supposed to live our lives. And it's very hard to transform our lives from whatever standards we've lived up until that point. Very hard. But beside the fact that there's responsibility to do it, there is a concept expressed in a book called Sefer HaChinuch, who expresses this concept many, many times. And the concept is as follows. I'm telling it to you in Hebrew because I love the Hebrew words, and for those who are capable, I think it's worth even memorizing the Hebrew words. He says, Adam nif'al achar pe'ulosav. A person becomes who he becomes based on his actions. Meaning, very important idea. The internal self is affected by the external behaviors. Very often we think the external behaviors should be a function of the internal self. So that once I am a generous person, I do generous things. But actually, the Torah says, do all these things. You're not generous. You don't even like your parents. Right? But do these things, and you will find that by virtue of carrying out these things, it will impact who you are. You know, part of being a shul rabbi is taking care of people. From the beginning of my career and even today, that doesn't come perfectly naturally to me. But I do the disciplines of taking care of people, and I have found inside that I begin to care more about people. And so that's the gift of Torah is telling you to... I'll give you a perfect example. If you pray with the Siddur, okay? A, nobody would have prayed by default themselves in plural. People by default themselves pray in singular. The Siddur teaches you to pray in plural, to care about other people. People seldom pray for global concerns, like rebuild Jerusalem. Okay? But if you're listening to the Siddur, it teaches you and makes you have global concerns. If you stand for scholars, if you dress nicely for Shabbat, these things give you esteem. The behaviors give you esteem for things. Just like when you say to your children, we're going to the wedding, you have to dress nicer. The child learns that a wedding is important. Right? And all of the elements of Torah are God's gift to us to become inside the kind of people we want to be, we wish we could be. We're just not there yet, all I'm on the journey, right? So on the journey, which is real, requires taking steps, and when we take the steps, we internalize and we become the things that we hoped and wish we could become. Okay, we're going to have to stop for now. And we're going to have to pick it up again because it's lovely to be with you. So, okay, a pleasure.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.